Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history with Liz Covart. The study of history is key to understanding who we are and how we can affect a better future. Ben Franklin's World will introduce you to historical people and events that have impacted and shaped our present-day world. And now, here's your host, Liz Covart.
Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of Ben Franklin's World, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn more about how the people and events of our early American past have shaped the present-day world we live in. Each week, we sit down with an historian to discuss their unique insights into our early American past so we can learn more about who we are and how we can affect a better future. Do you know who wrote the Declaration of Independence? If you answered Thomas Jefferson, you would only be partly right. Jefferson drafted the first draft of a document that he and others authored. Daniel Allen, foundation professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, and author of Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality, will lead us on an exploration of the Declaration of Independence. In today's episode, Danielle will reveal how New Hampshire's need for a government in 1776 led the Continental Congress to start writing the Declaration of Independence, the many authors of the Declaration of Independence, and how undertaking a slow reading of the Declaration will help us understand and unlock all of the ideas contained within it. But first, Danielle wrote Our Declaration because she would like every American to read the Declaration of Independence and really understand its powerful ideas. To this end, I would like to give away a copy of Our Declaration. At the end of our conversation, I will reveal how you can enter to win it.
With tidings and wisdom to share about our early American past, here is this week's special guest.
Today, we welcome Danielle Allen, a foundation professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Her research interests include justice and citizenship in both ancient Athens and modern America. She is the author of four books, including Why Plato Wrote and Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality. Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, Danielle.
Thanks, Liz. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited you're here because we're going to talk about the Declaration of Independence, which, as you know, is one of the most important documents in the history of the United States. But more than just discussing its history, we're actually going to talk about how to read the document.
That's right.
In fact, it was the challenge you posed in Our Declaration that all Americans should undertake a slow reading of the document that attracted me to your work. So, Danielle, before we dive into Our Declaration, I understand that you are not a historian, but a political theorist. Would you tell us what a political theorist is and what kind of research and scholarship you engage in?
Sure. So a political theorist or a political philosopher is somebody who tackles the what I think of as all-embracing questions about politics. What is justice? What is democracy? What does it take to make a democracy just and fair? What is power? How can power get organized in ways that permit us to protect ideals like liberty and equality? So the work involves understanding the ideals that make it possible to make something good out of political life, and then thinking about the relationship between those ideals and the institutions, laws, and customs or ordinary habits that make it possible to bring those ideals into being.
And so is it bringing those ideals into being what attracted you to study the Declaration of Independence so carefully?
So the Declaration is just, it's an extraordinary text, as you know, and I think it does a beautiful job of simultaneously being explicit and profoundly thoughtful about the content of ideals and exemplifying how to put them into practice. So the document is an extremely procedural document. It's an effort of a group of people to come to agreement about a self-definition, and there are amazingly elaborate procedures that lie behind the production of the document, in which you can see, in some sense, in the document. And that proceduralism, or making real, is connected to the very ideals of equality and independence and freedom that are articulated in the document. So yes, that drew me to it.
Now, when I sat down to undertake your challenge, to undertake my own slow reading of the document, I opened up our declaration and I started to read the introduction. And much to my surprise, you said, you don't necessarily need to know the history of the document to understand it. And I wonder if you could just explain what you mean by that.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. And I should probably clarify a little bit about myself, my personal history, in the sense that I currently work as a political philosopher, and I have a PhD in political theory or political philosophy, which also includes the study of the history of political thought. But I have a sort of funny background in that I also did an earlier PhD in ancient history. So I am actually trained as a historian. So when I say that you don't need to read history or don't need to know a lot of history to read and understand the Declaration, I'm actually saying that from the perspective of somebody who loves history, trained as a historian, and so forth. So how exactly can somebody who's committed to history make that kind of claim about the Declaration? The key point, I think, for me is that the Declaration itself is telling a story about human agency, and it's telling a story about the sorts of human agency that we achieve in politics through the use of words, which means that the Declaration already puts an incredibly huge premium on the capacity of language itself to help people towards understanding. And so I think taking the Declaration seriously actually requires taking that starting premise seriously. So it's very carefully written. It adheres to principles of logic, traditions of logical argumentation, which existed in the 18th century and exists still today. So in that regard, with regard to its language, its rhetoric, its use of logical structures, it's actually part of a continuous tradition where our approach to those things now is not so different from the approach in the 18th century. So that focus on language gives us access to, again, a point of continuity between that time period and the present. That's not to say that that historical context doesn't matter. It does also matter, and certainly particular words change their meaning over time. But I think you can dive into the Declaration, and if you try to understand any given word in the Declaration with reference to the other words in the Declaration, what you've actually gotten already is sort of a map, a sort of treasure map that takes you itself into the context that you need to understand those words without having to do lots of other reading about the 18th century.
You know what? Even though in the introduction it says, understand the Declaration on its own terms, you don't necessarily need historical context, you actually provide a lot of historical context for the document before we undertake our slow reading and examine every word and sentence of the document. And what I found interesting about your context is this was something I didn't know. I mean, for most people, the story of how the Declaration came to be is quite familiar. Many people in the 13 colonies, they disagree with the economic, military, and legal policies imposed by Great Britain between the 1760s and 1770s, so they protest. And they protest until it becomes clear that Great Britain, Parliament, and specifically King George III aren't going to do anything to address those grievances. But you relate a very specific story about how New Hampshire needed a government, and that need led the Continental Congress to begin its authorship of the Declaration of Independence. Would you share that story with us?
That's right. No, thank you so much. That's a fantastic question. We've acquired this idea that you have to have a revolution first and then you write constitutions, whereas in fact, the process in the American experience was the other way around. So in June of 1775, New Hampshire's royal governor fled. So he did already have radicals who sort of were besieging him in his house. And so he fled to a British naval ship. New Hampshire was a highly centralized colony at the time. So all of the administration of the colony flowed through the governor. So at the level of the police and the judges and the legislative branches and so forth, everything required the governor's presence to operate. So the people of New Hampshire had a quandary. How on earth were they supposed to run themselves? And they sent to Continental Congress for advice. And it's really important then that in Congress, when that request for advice came in October of 1775, that two of the five men assigned to the committee to answer this question were John Adams and Richard Henry Lee, Adams of Massachusetts, Lee of Virginia. these two men were both in the Radical Party already in Congress. They were pretty much in favor of independence. But they also realized that they weren't going to get to independence without giving people a sort of picture of what they were headed to. So the New Hampshire quandary was an incredible opportunity for them, sort of intellectually and strategically. They had to answer the question for New Hampshire of what to do. And their answer was that New Hampshire should go ahead and write itself a constitution. So New Hampshire was the first colony to set itself up as a state, as it did with the Constitution in January of 1776. And beginning with that response to New Hampshire, Adams and Lee started a campaign to get other colonies to begin writing constitutions for themselves. Their argument was basically that the king had, in the fall of 1775, declared the colonies out of their protection. And therefore, they all had to recognize that they basically didn't have any governments. How could they possibly be the king's magistrates if the king, you know, was no longer keeping them in his protection? So the king, they argued, had effectively thrown the colonies into anarchy. They had no choice but to set up new governments. And so that process was well underway before they could decide to declare independence. So by July 4th, there were already a handful of colonies, four or five, that had written their constitutions, with several others in process. And Adams was very clear in his to-do list for Congress in February of 1776 that the first thing was to get all the colonies to institute their own governments, and then further down his list came the idea that they need to declare independency. So it was this quandary in New Hampshire, this moment where they found themselves without a government, that provoked them to a process of constitution forming, which that was really the foundation for independence. So that's a really important revision to our sense of the story. So constituting came actually before revolting, as it happens.
You know, it's funny, you know, we have such a glorious picture of the American Revolution in our mind, but we often forget what a scary event it was. These protests were really violent. But added to that fear is the fact that King George III, you know, says you are no longer protective. And then in the case of New Hampshire, they're actually without a government. So that must have really added to the fear of the event.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the ways I really enjoy, I really enjoy sort of picking up the fear of the moment. How can you enjoy that? But to feel that you are there and present and can feel the tension of the moment, I think a great way to do that is to read the correspondence between John Adams and his wife, Abigail. So John was in Philadelphia with Continental Congress, and Abigail was in Braintree, Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, of course, had seen armed clashes between the colonists and the British as early as April of 1775. So they are living with, actual violence erupting continuously and regularly. And John Adams writes to Abigail, and he wants news. And she writes back with the very clear articulations of the sense of anxiety and the worry about whether a particular place is going to get attacked. And what does that mean for people? So there's a real powerful sense of vulnerability that comes out of those letters.
That's a great suggestion. And the Massachusetts Historical Society and the Adams Papers Editorial Project provides many of those letters online. So I'll include a link to those letters in the show notes for this
episode.
That
would be fantastic. I think they're a true treasure trove, and I really wish more people would dive into them.
So let's get to the writing of the document. If I were to ask you who wrote the Declaration of Independence, you'd likely say Thomas Jefferson. But Danielle, you contend that Jefferson merely wrote the first draft of a document authored by a group. Would you explain how the Declaration of Independence was written by a group and why democracies require what you call the distinctive art of group writing?
Sure. No, thanks a lot, Liz. So again, another terrific online resource is the Records of Continental Congress, which the Library of Congress has online. So maybe we could throw a link in there too.
Definitely.
But if you spend some time sort of surfing through those records, the extraordinary thing about it is just, you know, they wrote a lot of declarations. They wrote a lot of memos. They passed a lot of resolutions. And any time Congress passed a resolution, they would write a text to go with it to explain that resolution. So at the point that somebody gets assigned to draft one of those resolutions, there have already been extensive congressional conversations about what should be in the resolution. And then a group is basically given the job of trying to boil that all down and provide a document for everybody to argue over again and make their changes. So in the case of the Declaration, it's important to remember that actually in early May 7th through 15th, Adams had brought a resolution forward in which the Congress resolved that they would encourage all the colonies to institute new governments. And then Adams wrote the resolution, the text of the resolution that went with that. And a lot of the language of the Declaration is already there in that early May document. And then in early June, Richard Henry Lee stood up in Congress to resolve that the colony should declare their independency from Great Britain. They decided to defer the vote on the actual question of independency, but in order to prepare for a vote in early July, they decided to go ahead at that time and assign a committee to draft the declaration that would explain their resolution. So Adams, you know, the consummate politician, did the work of, you know, campaigning for people to be elected to that committee. He got Jefferson elected the head of the committee with the most votes and himself second. And then came Franklin and Sherman and Livingston. And Adams admired Jefferson's pen, and he knew this was an important resolution, an important document. He wanted one of the best writers to be at the head of the job. But once that committee is elected, then they had the job of talking about what would be in that declaration. And we can see those conversations. Actually, we know they talked about it because when you look at the pieces and parts of the Declaration, for example, if you take the list of grievances, the extraordinary thing about the list of grievances is that half of it has the structure of arguments that Adams has been making over the previous year, and the other half has the structure of arguments that Jefferson has been making. So right from that little detail, you can tell that they sat down and said, okay, well, what are going to be the parts of this Declaration? Okay, let's have this from me, Adams, this from you, Jefferson. We're going to put this together. Jefferson, you go off and give us the synthesis of all of this. So Jefferson did that. Then, of course, the document had to come back to Congress for further debate about its content. And Congress cut Jefferson's declaration by about 25%. So at every stage, different voices are weighing in about the shape of this document. And Jefferson really did just have the job of trying to express the common agreed upon opinion that the group was forming. So that's the sense in which the declaration represents a process of group writing, and it's polyphonic. I mean, you can still see the traces of different distinct voices in it that Jefferson, again, had the job of bringing together into a single coherent statement.
And another distinct voice that you haven't mentioned yet are the four printers who played an important role in authoring the Declaration of Independence. And I wonder if you would tell us how printers helped author a document that had already been written.
No, that's a fantastic question. And it really, it's an amazing story of the Declaration. So after Congress passes the final text, there's still the job of turning that into a text that other people can consume. Who needs to consume it? The general public, the military, which needs to understand the purpose of its fighting, and courts in Europe. And so how is that going to happen? The first thing that the Congress does is send the text to a printer named John Dunlap, who did the bulk of official congressional printing, and he produced what's called a broadside, basically a poster. And a few hundred copies of those that he finished immediately. So that was the July 4th and 5th text that was first available that went out again officially to the military and so forth. In his text, he introduces an unusual dash in the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence. The second sentence is the famous one about, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And it's an incredibly long sentence that starts from that first set of truths we know about, that we all have rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it moves from those individual rights through the argument that governments are instituted to secure those rights, and that therefore, when governments become destructive of those ends, we have the right to alter and abolish them and set up new governments. And it's an incredibly important, it's the core argument of the Declaration, the theory of revolution, the relationship of individual rights to the value of government for securing those rights and so forth. And there's this unusual phrase, pursuit of happiness, in it. And Dunlap, by putting a dash after it, gives it this extra emphasis. And so that's the sort of new picture of the Declaration. Then you also have the official record book in Continental Congress's minute book. So that's written out by the Secretary of Congress, Charles Thompson. That's actually a handwritten version. Then you have newspaper printings. And on July 6th, we get the first newspaper printing. And funnily enough, this one is not an authorized printing. On July 6th, Benjamin Town produces a version that does not come from the Dunlap version. Somebody else has slipped him a copy of the Declaration. Based on capitalization patterns, it looks as if Jefferson or one of his friends has slipped it to Town, whereas Dunlap is clearly working from a version from John Adams. At any rate, Town prints a version, and he changes the second sentence from how it's been in any prior manuscript, and he takes it and he breaks it into two with a period after pursuit of happiness. That's a pretty significant change because it gets picked up in a lot of places. Then you have, we have the fellow, Timothy Matlack, who was a clerk in Congress, who writes out the parchment declaration. So we would call him a calligrapher, really, rather than a printer. But that's really the most important document. That's the one that everybody signs. And he does this amazing thing late in the document of capitalizing an important we. He writes, you know, in every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress. And in all the manuscripts, that we is a small W, and he makes it a capital W. So he clearly wants to emphasize this new collective agent, we the people. And so that, I think, for me, that's where I like to see that that's the moment where the people is born, when this ordinary clerk in Congress decides he's going to capitalize that we. He's going to put his stamp on the document and indicate what he thinks is especially important about it. And then, you know, in January of 1777, the Congress, now on the run, they've left Philadelphia, they've moved to Baltimore because the British are in Philadelphia. Congress decides they need another official text so that each of the 13 now states can have a copy for their records. And so they ask a Baltimore printer named Mary Catherine Goddard to print up another version for them. And hers, too, has these distinctive changes. And so therefore, you can see her voice in the document. The thing that she does, which is different from any previous version, is to put all of the words for God, so creator, supreme being, divine providence, in all caps. So she's conveying that for her, the document really is grounded on an idea of what God has done. So you have these very different perspectives on the document. Matlack, for example, celebrating the idea of we the people, and Goddard celebrating the idea of God as providing a foundation for the document. So I like to say it's important to recognize that not only is the text polyphonic and has multiple voices in it, but then also the tradition, the textual tradition of printed and other manuscript but official versions of the text, they all have slightly different takes on what's in the declaration. And so right from the beginning, we can see that there are multiple versions of the text, multiple ways of understanding it. And we need to understand the value of the diversity of that tradition. There's no single, completely unified, original view of what document is right from the get-go. It's a very multiple, multifarious kind of document.
And it is pretty amazing. I mean, we take for granted, if we know how to read, you know, we take punctuation for granted. It just becomes second nature. But punctuation really helps us interpret and understand the language. And the printers, you know, they read the document, and their changes in punctuation show that they carefully considered it and then put punctuation they thought necessary into the document to help direct their readers to the points that they thought were most important.
Exactly. Yeah, there's this sort of myth afoot that punctuation was higgledy-piggledy in the period and didn't matter. And same with capitalization, and that's not quite right. Punctuation absolutely mattered, and already in the 18th century, punctuation was used to track syntax. So punctuation was used to convey meaning. So if syntax is how sentences are put together and what the grammar and logic of the sentence is, punctuation is pointing people to that already in the 18th century quite consistently. So changes in punctuation did mean that people were offering different interpretations of the text and pointing readers in the direction of taking different meanings from the text. With capitalization, it's a slightly different matter where there it is more stylistic, and in the sort of late, in the, you know, from the middle to late of the 18th century, the norm was to capitalize lots of nouns, you know, most of the important nouns. That was the sort of standard. And Jefferson was actually at the head of a vanguard, a stylistic vanguard, that wanted to just get rid of all that capitalization and do what we do now, where you capitalize at the beginning of sentences but not otherwise. And so at the end of the 18th century, in the period when the Declaration is first printed, you see a wide variation of capitalization patterns. And there it is less the case that a capitalization is meaningful. It is more simply a matter of stylistic conventions and which stylistic convention a printer felt like following.
So we've covered how the Declaration came to be and how the language in some ways came to be there. I wonder if you could talk about how we should undertake a slow reading of the document, just like you challenge in the book. And what can you tell us what makes slow reading different from reading at our normal speeds?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, yes, I think of slow reading in some sense is a little bit like deep sea diving or something like that, where you really get to go down and see things that you don't notice when you're just skimming along the surface in a speedboat. So you get to see sort of all the fish and schools of fish and how they're interacting with each other, or you can watch the dynamics between big fish and little fish and that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, again, if you're in a speedboat skipping along the surface, you still get to your destination. You get across to the island, but having missed all the life underneath living in the sea. And so to take that metaphor and apply it to a document, what that really means is when you read the Declaration fast, you basically get out of it in a kind of loose way. Okay, they expressed some principles. They had a list of complaints about the king, and then they declared independence. Voila, done. I've got the basic picture of the document. And that's true. That is a basic picture of the document. But if you really want to know what were those principles, then you actually have to really slow down and ask yourself about each sentence. Okay, well, where are they actually expressing their values in this sentence? They're partly expressing their values when they invoke concepts like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but they're actually also evoking their values when they say things like, when in the course of events it becomes necessary. The notion of necessity is a really important idea that people use to convey their values again. I mean, so when you define something as necessary, you are indicating that you have a sense of obligation, or else that you're facing something inescapable to which you have to have a response. And that response is going to be colored by your values. So there's a lot to be learned about the ideals from moving very slowly and really scrutinizing all the words to see where the values come in. And similarly with the grievances, I mean, it's not just a kind of random list of complaints about King George. There's a really impressive structure underneath it. First, they complain about violations to the legislative function, then they complain about violations to the judicial function, then they complain about violations to the executive function of government. So, whoa, look, there's a constitutional theory inside that list of grievances. And that's the kind of thing that if you just, you know, skim through the list, you won't pick up because you won't take the time to see the structure underneath it. So slowing down and asking, you know, how is this sentence put together? How is this group of sentences put together? What is the method of organization underneath them? What explains the word choice? How do these words relate to each other? So when we have invocations at the beginning of the document about independence, how has that word changed by the time we get to the end of the document and they've declared their independence? Or what have we learned about the definition of the word? To ask those kinds of questions is what it takes to slow down in one's reading. And the result is a much deeper understanding of the body of thought that lies behind the argument presented in the text.
So much of our declaration takes us through the Declaration of Independence line by line, and in some cases, word by word. And I was amazed that when I really took the time to read the 1,337 words, which is really only about, what, 5 pages of double-spaced type text.
Right, exactly. I mean, if that, you know, sort of one long op-ed or 2 op-eds is how I think of it.
Yeah, there's just not much there, but you helped us see things, or at least see what we should consider, even when the words weren't there. So, for example, you find 5 facets of equality that are described in the Declaration of Independence. And yet, when you read the Declaration of Independence, you won't find the word equality in there. Instead, you'll find that they use the word equal twice. Mm-hmm. You know, could you provide us with an example of maybe how we can uncover one of those 5 facets of equality, where we should look for it?
Sure. I mean, obviously, the word equal is important. And so that's a good example of how you can start understanding the word by looking at other instances in the document. So, you know, when we think about equality in the Declaration, we go in our heads, first of all, to the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of, you know, all men are created equal and endowed with the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We sort of think that that's how equality enters the document. Whereas, in fact, it enters in the first sentence when they describe a necessity to take their separate and equal place among the world's nations. So then you have to ask yourself, wow, you know, does this use of equal relate to that use of equal, or what is the relationship between the two of them? And that begins to open up a kind of field of inquiry as to what the meaning of equality is. And so then once you realize that in the first 2 sentences they've invoked this really important term, he has to ask, you say, well, gosh, well, you know, does equality come in some other place? Because as you point out, you know, the word doesn't come in. But then if you look closely, you begin to realize that there are places where synonyms to equality come in. So at the very end of the document, for example, they mutually pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to one another. And that idea of mutuality is closely related to the idea of equality. And so you begin to see that that mutual pledge is it indicates their egalitarian social bond and the fact that they've made that egalitarian social bond, their willingness to commit to each other and to share equally with each other mutually, they've made that the foundation of their fighting power, right? So in other words, their ability to plain old have their war for independence depends on that social foundation of egalitarianism. So you see that facet coming in that way. And then you sort of, you know, you look at the documents and ask, well, okay, well, does this idea come up elsewhere? And then you do begin to see other places. So when they say to the king, you know, in every stage of these oppressions, we petitioned for redress, and for every petition, we've only been met by repeated injury. That's there's no word for equality there, but the formulation is closely related to maxims about reciprocity, the need for people to respond to injuries. And reciprocity is another concept that, in the traditions of political thought, is closely linked to the concept of equality. So that's the way in which you can begin to sort of trace the conceptual network that is tethered to those first two early invocations of the concept of equality or of the equal at the beginning of the document.
So equality is inherent in the Declaration of Independence, which seems like that means we should really address the elephant in the room, right? I mean, for those of us who know our history, or at least some of the history behind the Declaration of Independence, how do we reconcile the fact that the language and argument of the document says that all men are created equal, and yet many of the white male founders did not necessarily mean to include men who didn't own property, women, or people of color in their definition of equal? I mean, many of the founders owned property and slaves.
So it's interesting. Yeah, no, there's no question about that. And that's a very hard thing to think about in relationship to the Declaration. And there are probably, I mean, I guess there are sort of two things I would say about that. I think the first and most important one is that they made a self-conscious distinction. They're very explicit in making a distinction between their principles and the organizational form they used to realize those principles. You can see that distinction at the end of the second sentence when they say that, you know, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish those governments that are destructive of individual rights and to set up new governments on the foundation of such principle and according to such form as shall seem to them most likely to affect their safety and happiness. And what this meant was that they actually could mean that the principle was one that involved all people, but they, in their moment, they were choosing a form that did not involve all people. Okay, let me try to make this concrete. We can see precisely that distinction at work, again, in the correspondence between John and Abigail Adams. So let me just read you something that Abigail wrote to John, March 31st of 1776. I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. So Abigail is being explicit. This principle means everybody. And when John responds to her, and actually when he also responds to a male friend in May of 1776, he says, yes, the principle does mean everybody, but we're going to stick with our patriarchal form for organizing that principle. And I don't endorse his decision at all. To the contrary, I think he made a mistake. I think Abigail was right, and she was right to predict that the ladies would foment a rebellion if they were bound by laws in which they had no voice or representation. It took its time, but it came. But the point is that they did understand the far-reaching implications of their principle and also understood that, therefore, there would be conflict, in effect, going forward over the institutional form that was used to make good on those principles. So that's, I suppose, I mean, I could say more about the those the relationship between the principles and organizational form and the sort of paradoxes and tensions in that. But I hope that gives at least some sense of the way in which they did recognize the content of their principles and had already begun to engage in argumentation about what that meant for their institutions.
I wonder if you would go into how the ideas of freedom and equality are connected. I mean, by the time I finished reading our Declaration, I was convinced that our Creator, our founders, and our forefathers had really given us a patrimony of both freedom and equality. And yet, so much of what we hear today in the news emphasizes only aspects of freedom. So I wonder if you would talk about how freedom and equality, you know, are in tandem with each other, that go together, and yet why so much of the emphasis is on freedom, and do we lose something by not emphasizing equality too?
Sure. No, thank you so much. I mean, the core idea is that if some people dominate others, that is to say, if there's inequalities that develop, then those who are dominated aren't free. So the only way in which you can actually pursue a course of freedom is if you achieve egalitarian relations among the people of a polity. So you can't have freedom unless it's freedom for all, and you can't have freedom for all unless you've built it on a foundation of equality. So equality is the ground of freedom. And that basic insight was the long-standing traditional way of thinking about the relationship between freedom and equality. It goes back to ancient Athens, goes back to ancient Rome. It characterized the political thought of the 17th and 18th centuries. And so the idea was that freedom and equality were mutually supporting. You needed each for the other. That belief in the mutual support of freedom and equality began to erode in the middle of the 19th century. And the story there is really a story about the rise of communism and socialism and the response of people against communism and socialism and the way in which that conversation developed. So, for instance, in the opening of the Communist Manifesto, Marx writes that it will be necessary to invade the property rights of the bourgeoisie to infringe their liberty, in effect, to achieve what he wants. And the response for the anti-communists is precisely to argue that now liberty and equality have been set in opposition to each other. So there is a political economist, for example, at the end of the 19th century at Yale named William Graham Sumner, who was one of very, very ardent anti-socialists. And he developed this pithy formulation in which he said, so, our choice is clear. Basically, the alternatives are freedom, no equality, or I should say that freedom, inequality, and survival of the fittest. So he connected it to sort of social Darwinianism, or equality, unfreedom, and survival of the least fit. And that formulation then fed into the ideologies that developed in the 20th century around the Cold War. So as the U.S. Sort of geared up in its fight against the Soviet Union, it defined itself as this is a fight between the side that was for liberty and the side that was for equality. And you can find this in a lot of, even in the as early as the 60s, there's sort of an article published in a journal, a libertarian journal called The Freeman, which is titled The Eternal Conflict Between Liberty and Equality. So in this period of 100 years, an age-old tradition of understanding equality and liberty as mutually supporting was broken. And I think we're still living with the consequences of having broken that link between equality and liberty. And so I see one of our absolutely most pressing political needs as being to reconstitute our understanding of the ways in which equality and liberty, again, are mutually supporting, mutually constituting concepts.
And perhaps if more people undertake a slow reading of the Declaration of Independence, perhaps you can cause that movement.
Well, I sure hope so. Absolutely. That would be fantastic. No question about it. So I would be delighted if that were something that happened.
Well, let's continue our conversation about the equality aspect of the Declaration of Independence in the time warp. Now, this is a fun segment of the show where we ask you a hypothetical history question about what might have happened if something had occurred differently or if someone had acted differently.
The time warp. Historians can't predict the future, but they can speculate about what might have been.
So let's talk about if the Continental Congress had acted differently. If Thomas Jefferson had had his way, The final version of the Declaration of Independence would have included lines that charged King George III with waging a, quote, cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. That's a hard word to say, end quote.
It is, yeah.
Furthermore, Jefferson charged George III with being, quote, determined to keep open a market where men, and that's all capitalized, should be bought and sold, end quote. So, Danielle, in your opinion, what might have happened if the Committee of Five or the Continental Congress had allowed Thomas Jefferson to keep those lines in the Declaration of Independence? How would they alter our understanding of the document, and would those lines have changed the course of United States history in any way?
That's a fantastic question, and I do think they would have changed the course of United States history. The Declaration, in my view, is a document that does tip slightly in an anti-slavery direction. And my view is confirmed, ironically, by the Confederates, who in the middle of the 19th century wrote their own Declaration of Independence, and they said explicitly, we have to write a new one because that first one was no good, and it was no good because it argued that all men are created equal, whereas our government will be the first one in history to be founded on the principle that the white man is superior to the Negro. So the Confederates themselves saw the Declaration as being an anti-slavery document. But it took really 60 years for people to come to full clarity about that point. And I think if that language of Jefferson's that you just quoted had been included from the get-go, the anti-slavery meaning and consequence of the Declaration would have been evident much sooner. They were evident in the sense that some participants in these conversations, John Dickinson, a member of Continental Congress, did free his slaves in the wake of the Declaration. He was the only member of Continental Congress to do so, but he did do so. And in the wake of the Declaration, conversations in Pennsylvania began to move towards the abolition of slavery there. So we can see that in that way that the Declaration did have meaning for people in an abolitionist direction. But I think that meaning would have been powerfully accelerated if that text hadn't been cut out. And so, you know, I think what that means is that, I don't know whether what that means is that civil war would have come sooner or whether we would have found a way through the slavery issue without descending into civil war. I couldn't say which of those things it is, but I do think the question of slavery would have been resolved far sooner if that language had not been cut from the Declaration.
And that language is included in a chapter of our Declaration. So if people want, you can go read the book and consider which of those scenarios you think would have been most likely.
That's great. Yeah, no, that's terrific. Time warp.
So Danielle, before we conclude, what are you researching and writing about now? I mean, can we look forward to a sequel called Our Constitution?
I'm not certainly not in the near future. In all honesty, I'm still doing lots of work on the Declaration. So there are lots of loose ends that I don't think I quite got to in the book. So, for instance, I've mentioned a few times in this conversation the correspondence between Abigail and John. It's a fascinating correspondence, and I really think there's a lot of the story that I didn't tell that ought to be told that comes out of their correspondence. And some of that story is about this question of how they responded to recognizing and being forced, as Abigail forced John, to recognize that those big principles of human equality did include the ladies, as she puts it. I think there's still a lot more to be said about the work that language of the Declaration was doing for a general project of human equality. And again, as I said, I think there may be something coming out from me about John and Abigail and their conversations about politics.
Great. We look forward to seeing those. What you have to say about John and Abigail Adams.
Thank you so much.
Where's the best place to look for more information about you, your work, and how to get in contact with you?
The best place would be the website of the Institute for Advanced Study. So I'm not going to be able to tell you it's just www.ias.edu. If you go to faculty and look for me, that should take you to my personal homepage.
Well, we'll even make it easier. We'll include a link right to your personal homepage in the show notes with all of the other documents we've talked about today.
Fantastic. That's great.
Well, this has been great. I hope more people undertake a slow reading of the Declaration of Independence because it really opened my eyes. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm so glad. Yes, I hope people will pick up the slow reading project. I mean, it's a heck of a lot of fun.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us on Ben Franklin's World.
Thanks for having me, Liz. Have a great day.
In order to fully understand the powerful and still relevant ideas of the Declaration of Independence, we must first read the document slowly and digest its words. Danielle provided us with a few tips for how we can undertake a slow reading of the Declaration. We must watch punctuation, look up words in the dictionary when they don't evoke a clear definition in our minds, and we must follow the Declaration's argument. Danielle wrote our declaration because she would like every American to read and unlock the powerful ideas of the Declaration of Independence. I would like to help her fulfill that dream. To this end, I am giving away one copy of Our Declaration. To enter, complete the following steps. Visit the show notes page for this episode, benfranklinsworld.com/018. Click on the link to either the John and Abigail Adams correspondence or the Journals of the Continental Congress. Select and read one letter or journal entry. Return to the show notes page and tell us about the letter or journal entry you read in the comments section. I will randomly select the winner on March 9, 2015 and announce it in Poor Richard's Club. So if you haven't signed up to join our social community, you can do so after you leave your comment by signing up to receive the Franklin Gazette, the official newsletter of Ben Franklin's World, which will provide you with access to Poor Richard's Club. Finally, what do you think would have happened if the Continental Congress and the Committee of Five had let Thomas Jefferson keep his anti-slavery passages in the final draft of the Declaration of Independence? Tweet me your answer at Liz Covart or send me an email, liz@benfranklinsworld.com. And of course, you could also leave a comment on the show notes page while you were there to enter the book giveaway.
And remember, never leave till tomorrow that which you can do today.